Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. The headlines this week: fiscal cliff, corruption trials, a collision, and its causes on the MBTA. First, Governor Deval Patrick announces a $540 million budget gap in the state budget and says it's because of the fiscal cliff.
By all accounts, that uncertainty and the resulting slowdown in economic growth is the direct cause of our budget challenges.
Also this week, closing arguments in the corruption trial of former Massachusetts Treasurer Tim Cahill. The prosecution paints one picture.
It reminds me of somebody getting their hand caught in a cookie jar.
The defense paints another.
Tim Cahill is guilty of nothing more than being a tough Quincy kid following his dreams.
And the MBTA fires the operator responsible for last week's Green Line trolley crash. He'd been working a second full-time job.
I'm not sure we can legislate what people do outside of the MBTA. However, they obviously are aware that they need to be fit for duty when they come in.
Those are some of the big stories we'll dig into now with two members of our Week in Review team. Joining us are Dante Ramos, Deputy Editorial Page Editor for the Boston Globe. Dante, great to have you back on the show.
Thanks for having me. Happy Friday, everybody.
Happy Friday. And also with us from Providence is Scott McKay. He's the political analyst for Rhode Island Public Radio. Scott, great to have you back as well.
Oh, it's wonderful to be on.
So let's start with the announcement this week that Massachusetts faces a $540 million budget shortfall. And why?
Economists agree that the fiscal cliff is keeping a tremendous amount of private capital on the sidelines. Business leaders I meet confirm that fact. The private sector will be unwilling to make the kinds of investments that create jobs, grow state and federal tax revenue collections, and contribute to lasting economic recovery until Congress and the president come to terms on a solution.
So that, of course, is Governor Deval Patrick talking this week about why he thinks we have that massive budget shortfall. And Jay Gonzalez, the state's Secretary of Administration and Finance, agrees with the governor, but he also suggests that there may be a little more to this.
The fiscal cliff is certainly a large part of it. It's not the only factor. There are other factors. Economists will tell you that the situation in Europe is hurting Massachusetts. 40% of our exports go to Europe. So when their economy's hurting, and they aren't buying as much from us, that hurts us too.
So, Dante, let's start with you. What do you think is motivating Governor Deval Patrick to draw such a direct line here between our budget and negotiations in Washington?
Well, I think, first of all, the account that Jay Gonzalez gives of the situation is probably a lot closer to the reality than the governor's. You know, the fact of the matter is that there's a lot of reasons to be concerned about the state budget and the effects that, you know, research cuts and other federal programs should have on Massachusetts. You know, as for the governor's motivation, there's been some speculation that Patrick, who spent months talking up the recovery when he was a surrogate for Barack Obama, who, of course, is a good friend of his, you know, now is in a position where he has to pivot around and say that the fiscal cliff is slowing things in the state right now. I mean, I think that that's probably too cynical a view also. You know, there's just a lot of reasons to be concerned about the trajectory of the state budget, of which the fiscal cliff is certainly one.
Well, Scott, take us down to Rhode Island. I mean, the state's been struggling with double-digit unemployment. The recession's hit especially hard there. What effect is all the wrangling in Washington having on the Ocean State?
Well, it's a real problem, the same as Massachusetts, except that I would argue that our New Year's Day hangover is going to be even worse because we have not only double-digit unemployment, but a more fragile economy than most other states, particularly our New England neighbors. And the estimates here are that it would shrink consumer spending by about $70 million and increase taxes for about 400,000 Rhode Island families. That's a real problem right now. And as far as what Governor Patrick says, people here, economists, business groups, are saying the same thing. Basically, what they say is that the fiscal cliff is already making trouble for the economy because it's leading business leaders just to delay decisions. Wait another month or two, at least, before buying that new machine if you're a manufacturer, or hiring new workers. I mean, you can't expect a business person to make an informed decision if he or she doesn't know what the tax rates or the health care rules are going to be effect in 3 or 4 weeks.
You know, Dante, before we move on to the next topic, I just briefly want to ask you, Scott mentioned that 400,000 Rhode Island families would see their federal taxes go up. The White House also released numbers about what would happen in Washington, what would happen in Massachusetts, I should say, if America goes off that fiscal cliff, saying some 562,000 Massachusetts families would lose access to the child tax credit, for example. I mean, do you think this information campaign by the president is an effective one?
You know, there's so many ways that the fiscal cliff can resolve itself, and all of them are probably going to have negative effects on somebody. I mean, obviously, people who are at the edge of their finances and are going to lose benefits and have their taxes go up. You know, it's a real problem for them. You know, an issue in Massachusetts. You know, this has become tangled up in the state budget discussion. And every year, you know, we're in a situation where every year there's talk of a budget shortfall. And it's partly because the state's, is said to have a structural deficit, meaning that we have a certain set of commitments on everything from higher education to human services. And we also have a certain amount that we can be expected to have come in every year through tax revenues. And those numbers really haven't been in balance at any time in recent memory. So, it's obvious that the fiscal cliff aggravates the situation, but there's a kind of underlying problem that is hard to untangle from what's going on.
So that's precisely what's happening in Rhode Island, where Governor Chafee, who liked Deval Patrick, supported President Obama, even though Governor Chafee's an independent, used to be a Republican at one time. But we have this structural deficit of about $130 million. And it's almost outside the cliff. The cliff is just making it worse. And I think Dante's
exactly
right when he talks about the political implications here.
Gentlemen, let's move on to politicians' alleged corruption and conflict of interest. First, in the corruption trial of former state treasurer Tim Cahill, he and his former top aide Scott Campbell are accused of using state lottery funds to run ads in support of his failed gubernatorial campaign. Here's prosecutor James O'Brien making his closing arguments earlier this week.
It was understood by everybody, including Mr. Cahill and including Scott Campbell, who was on that email from July 27th, that they were going to use the lottery's ad money to further Mr. Cahill's campaign.
Not so, says Jeffrey Denner, Tim Cahill's defense attorney. Here he is in his closing argument.
The prosecution is saying is essentially that Mr. Cahill hijacked the lottery for his own personal gain. If he did, he certainly did a horrible job.
So the jury is in its third day of deliberations. Dante, let me start with you. What do you make of this trial? Some critics say that Attorney General Martha Coakley was overzealous in bringing charges against Cahill, who might be guilty of nothing more than sort of politics. But other people see another Massachusetts politician using his position for personal benefit. What do you see here?
Well, I think Tim Cahill isn't the only one who's on trial here. This is also the first major test case, and maybe even the first test case of this 2009 ethics reform law that makes it a criminal rather than a civil offense for a politician, I'm sure I'll describe this wrong, to use his or her office to obtain unwanted privileges and presumably access to $1.5 million or $1.8 million in lottery money for political gain would qualify under that. But I'm not sure that the legislature understood the implications of that when they passed the law. I would almost expect, no matter how this trial turns out, for that law to be reexamined in the future, in part because there's a lot of people who feel like, at the least, the line between what's legal and what's not legal has been kind of fuzzy. I will say also that this law has had some what I would view as positive effects already. Cahill's successor, Steve Grossman, made a big show of taking his name off of the unclaimed property list that many Massachusetts listeners may have seen. And, to avoid running afoul of the idea that he's using public money and public prerogatives for his own political gain. There's something that I think is positive when politicians avoid appearances of impropriety rather than seeing what they can get away with.
Sure. Scott, Dante, made reference to that fuzzy line between what's legal and what's not legal. Rhode Island knows something about political corruption trials. What do you hear in this story?
Well, lately we've had things that have been a little less baroque. You know, the line in Rhode Island between legal and illegal is something that you draw in the sand at low tide. For instance, rarely does a month or two go by that we don't have another politician ending his career with a plea bargain. We've had two recently, one as a state representative who decided he did not have to pay hundreds of thousands of dollars in his business to the federal government in taxes, and looks like he's going to be headed off to a penitentiary. And we had a mayor of the poorest state in Rhode Island, a city in Rhode Island, and one of the poorest cities in all of New England, a guy named Charles Moreau, who's also headed to federal prison for taking kickbacks on the boarding up of foreclosed houses in this very poor city. So that obviously is a little different than, you know, Cahill, where the lines look somewhat blurry.
Yeah. Scott, let me ask you about another story down there in Rhode Island. This is a case that's being closely watched across the country. The state passed a package of pension cuts last year. Now public employee unions are suing to have some of those benefits restored. But the judge assigned to the case, Sarah Taft Carter, acknowledged that her son, mother, and her uncle are all earning or receiving state pensions. Lawyers are asking for another judge, but Taft Carter says her family connections would not affect her ability to be impartial. Scott, tell us a little more about this case and how folks are responding to it.
Well, welcome to Rhode Island, where there's no conflict with my interest. It's interesting because every judge is in the state pension system. Yeah. She's known as a fairly erudite judge. She's been dealing with this issue now for a while. The people who want her thrown off, perhaps, are judge shopping. So far, we're in the middle of a 9-inning game, and the unions lead 2-0 after the first inning. What's happened is that both Judge Taft Carter and the Rhode Island Supreme Court just yesterday have refused the state's motion to throw this case out. They want to give the plaintiffs, who of course are the public employee unions, their due process and discovery. And so what's happened is the state general treasurer, Gina Raimondo, who is one of the major proponents of this deal, which cut pension benefits for retirees and current state employees, went out and hired Donald Boies, the famous New York super lawyer, to come in, and he's only charging $50 an hour. And we know him from the Al Gore, Bush case, of course, and the Microsoft case, the Westmoreland case against CBS. This guy's a very celebrated national lawyer. And he came into town, and I guess he ordered a $235 bottle of wine with dinner last night at the Westin Hotel. So that's a little rich for Rhode Islanders.
Dante, what do you hear in this story? I understand you're a fellow Rhode Islander.
Yeah,
I just learned that before I came on the air. So here you are. What do you make of this story?
Well, you know, I think that Rhode Island is on the leading edge of a lot of kind of complicated and maybe not so hot things right now. You know, it's on the leading edge of the pension crisis. You know, on the more positive side, it's on the leading edge of, I guess, of pension reforms to deal with that crisis. But then in response to that, it's in the leading edge of a broader problem, which is a lot of state pension systems. You know, they're all dependent upon these very baroque state laws that, you know, every state has very different laws regarding it. But a common thread in every state that has tried to deal with this is that the judges who rule on these things are state employees, are in the state pension system. And, you know, it's really difficult even for somebody who's a very good judge whose family is, you know, she has, I gather, a son. Scott, correct me if I'm wrong. She has a son who's in the system, a mother who's in the system, to kind of look at it with completely, you know, completely neutral eyes. We have here in Massachusetts a 1973 advisory opinion that suggests that public pensions are contracts that can't be modified after day one of a public employee's participation. My guess is that if Massachusetts were as bad off economically as Rhode Island, we'd see some further litigation on that. But, you know, for the moment, a lot of people want to steer clear of it. It's an issue that will get resolved in Rhode Island first, and I think a lot of other states are closely watching what's going on, which says a lot of why David Boies is participating.
There's also some push from the union side and actually from Governor Chafee to try to get the two sides to sit down and craft a settlement before we get into a lengthy, protracted, and of course, very expensive litigation Lollapalooza.
Well, gentlemen, on that Lollapalooza note, if I could just turn the corner to one last story that we want to touch upon in our Week in Review, and that is the MBTA here in the greater Boston area. Because this week, a Green Line driver who was operating a train with less than 3 hours of sleep when he rear-ended another trolley, he was fired by the T. The T said that the driver had another full-time job with the Boston Housing Authority. Here's acting MBTA General Manager Jonathan Davis.
I'm not sure we can legislate what people do outside of the MBTA. However, they obviously are aware that they need to be fit for duty when they come in.
Okay, but in fact, in other cities across the country, there are best practices out there. The Federal Transportation Administration has strict guidelines on sleep and rest. And in other cities, such as Los Angeles, train and bus drivers are required to inform supervisors about outside work. Here's Mark Lippman with the LA County MTA.
We need to know what the second job entails. Particularly, we want to know if it entails driving, because we don't want someone to be fatigued when they're driving a 15 to 20 ton bus or a train and get into an accident.
So, Dante, my brief question to you is, this isn't the first time the T has had to deal with sleep issues on especially Green Line train drivers. Why do you think they're being so passive about this?
I find it absolutely impossible to explain. It seems pretty obvious that that there's things that the T can and should do. It's possible that this is something that that would end up being negotiated in a labor contract, and maybe at some point in the past it came up. But I don't have any special insight into why they didn't do it. It just seems obvious that they should have.
Scott, do you have any thoughts about that? Are things different in Rhode Island?
Well, we haven't had anybody in this position recently. However, we've had troubles in the past with drivers, but it hasn't been this kind of an issue. I wonder if they can't do what the airlines do, which pilots are required to have a certain amount of sleep between flights. And that would seem, as Dante says, to make a lot of sense.
Yeah, we'll keep our eyes on this.
You know, there's maybe there's an aspect of the story that I just think is so interesting in this current economy, and that is why a T driver feels the need to be working two jobs. I mean, it says something about the pressure that middle class folks might be under.
Well, in fact, his job with the T was his second job. He'd mm-hmm. been working at the Boston Housing Authority for several decades before that. But anyway, we'll keep our eye on this story. And while we have time, let's touch upon our weekly hubbubs. Anthony, you first.
Okay, Scott, Dante, tonight, Boston College men's hockey team takes on Providence College down in Rhode Island. If Jerry York, he's the coach of the Boston College men's hockey team, wins, he becomes the winningest coach in NCAA hockey history. So quite a milestone for Jerry York. It would be his 925th career victory. When he started his career in 1972, his father-in-law jabbed him about, he said, according to Jerry York, come on, my boy, you got to get a job now. And here he is 924 victories later. Quite a milestone. Oh, wow. So I know you guys are both Rhode Island boys, but I'm saying go Eagles.
Scott, what do you think about that, and what's your hubbub?
Well, I tell you, Jerry York and Jack Parker at BU are two of the absolute top hockey coaches in the country. And the beauty of being in Boston is we don't have the Bruins this year, but, you know, sometimes the best college hockey team on Commonwealth Avenue is the best college hockey team in the country. And both of those schools have won national championships, BC more recently than BU. But I think that the Bean Pot is a fabulous tournament. But what I'm thinking about is something bad that actually ended up creating something really good this week. And I was, in the spirit of the season, I was very heartened to see what happened after that bottom feeder showed up at St. Anne's Church in Shrewsbury and stole the presents. And this is another thing where Rhode Island and Massachusetts, Hasbro, the Pawtucket, Rhode Island-based toy maker, stepped up here, and their employees delivered more than 300 toys to the church in Shrewsbury, St. Anne's, to replace the ones that were stolen. I thought that was an uplifting story of the spirit of the holiday, which is great here in Rhode Island, because all we do is fight about the holiday tree and the fact that the governor didn't call it a Christmas tree. And we're on Bill O'Reilly with Fox News, and I'm like, fabulous. This is a great, great holiday story.
Absolutely great story. Dante, want to help bring us home here with the hubbubs?
Well, you know, everything we've been talking about today is all economic doom and gloom. But at the other extreme, it was very encouraging to read in our paper this week that tech workers in Boston startups sector are actually complaining about getting too many job offers. For recruiters, it's a problem. There's one guy who actually said he has to make 300% more calls in order to just fill a single position. But for people with engineering and computer skills who are happy in their current jobs, all the phone calls actually turned out to be pretty wearying. The other funny part of this is that, you know, the situation ends up capturing the same divide that exists on college campuses between the techies and the poets. There was one engineer who complained to the Globe that recruiting seems to be a default career path for English majors.
Well, my hubbub has to do with something that maybe all those people might want to pay attention to and find a future in. And it has to do with Maria Zuber, who's the MIT geoscientist who's head of a satellite-based mission to the moon that's just uncovering these incredible discoveries about our nearest heavenly neighbor, including that the moon might be covered with these very deep fractures that extend miles below the surface of the moon. And, I mean, this is... human beings set foot on there, you know, more than four decades ago, but there's still so much to be uncovered by our nearest neighbor. And the greatest thing about it is that she doesn't think it's that big of a deal that she's the first woman to lead a major planetary mission for NASA. She just says it's, for me, the most gratifying thing, quote, is that it just worked. So my hubbub today is Maria Zuber. And
so you mean it's not really green cheese, according to somebody at MIT?
In fact, that is indeed what I'm saying. So on that celestial note, Scott McKay, political analyst for Rhode Island Public Radio, always great to have you. Thanks so much.
Great to be here.
And Dante Ramos, deputy editorial page editor for the Boston Globe. Thanks to you as well.
Thank you.
Hey, Dante, Ian says hello.
Tell him I said hello also.